Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Because, you know, depending on who the guest is, I don't want to completely vibe them out.
You don't want to vibe them out?
Mm-hmm. Is that not a saying? I don't know. Just fucking leave me alone.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer. Bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Sarah Lipman. Sarah is the author of the story collections Jerks, out now on Mason Jar Press, and Doll Palace. She was awarded an Artist's Fellowship in Fiction from New York Foundation for the Arts, and her work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Millions, Fourth Genre, Slice Magazine, Volume 1 Brooklyn, Diagram, Squalorly, and elsewhere. She's landed on Wigleaf's Top 50, whoop, whoop, and her stories have been anthologized in Mamas and Papas, On the Sublime and Heartbreaking Art of Parenting from San Diego City Works Press, and forthcoming in New Voices, Contemporary Voices Confronting the Holocaust on Blue Lyra Press, and Best Small Fictions 2020 on Sonder Press. Raised outside of Philadelphia, she teaches in Brooklyn, where she lives with her family and co-hosts the Sunday Salon NYC. Thank you for being here, Sarah.
Welcome.
Goodness, you guys got the unabridged version of that bio.
Love it.
I found it in your press release, and I was like, maybe I'll edit this down. And then I was like, no, I want all of this in. It's too good.
Load it up.
Yeah.
Let her sound like the jerk that she is. There we go.
The jerk who wrote Jerks. Here she is.
Excellent. So I'm going to read a small piece from the book, the collection. I'm going to read a flash piece, and actually it's a flash piece that has now since inspired a novel project that I'm supposed to be working on, but really just procrastinating from.
Wait, is this Lech?
No. So Lech is coming out in October, but this is like, I'm working on this Philadelphia book. Well, ostensibly working on this Philadelphia book, but I'm not really working on it at all. But it's nice to pretend like I'm working on it.
We're familiar with that way of working.
So we're going to pretend that I'm working on that book, and that this is the flash piece that inspired that project.
Yay.
The title is There's a Joke Here Somewhere, and it's on me. I mistook the Catholic schoolgirls for friends until I learned my mom paid them 50 cents an hour to pick me up from elementary and walk me home, knee socks slouched and kilts rolled at the hip. Philomena and Therese brought hairspray, brought boys, brought cigarettes. They watched Dancing on Air from the bus station size black and white in the kitchen while I broke ramen into melamine. When they raided the back cabinet for dusty pints of banana liqueur, one called Blue Lagoon, the hue of 2000 flushes, Holly showed up on her bicycle with a bell shaped like Jesus. Holly switched the dial to Bob Ross and his Happy Little Trees, but money went missing. From there on, it took little convincing. MTV watched me. I watched MTV. Legs, Hot for Teacher. Sometimes I'd remove the sleeve of condoms from my mother's nightstand and stretch them over the spout, plump and jellied, launch them from her bedroom window. We shared our driveway with a rabbi and his wife. The wife pinned her laundry to an outdoor rack, web bent like an antenna searching for signal, flaunted tablecloths and bloomers, big and white. One night she knocked in cat-shaped glasses to report her asphalt findings, held the splattered remains with tweezers to the light where they shimmered like molted skin. Did my mother know the child she was raising, who I was, the kind of person I'd be, left alone, exposed to elements, how I'd turn out if my mom wasn't careful? My soul was at risk. Someone should keep an eye out. The rabbi's wife offered her services. My mother said, Thank you very much. I was 9. By 11, Sally Sellers' family would practically adopt me. In 1984, I had Bruce Springsteen. I had Dancing in the Dark. I lay on my mother's bed, mandala print, drinking Coke from the liter, lips feathered in sour cream and onion. I watched Bruce bop to the beat, side to side, as if to an earlier era, his hand swinging, his hand reaching, his hand ticking toward Courtney Cox, a ruse, of course, but I believed then. I believed in his glance, that moment, hey, baby, the outstretched hand, the other wrist doing that little flip, that she had been plucked from anonymity, that a person could be found like that. It was the only happy ending I needed. I watched the denim hug his hips, his groin thrumming, teeth teasing out a bite from his bottom lip. Decades later, I'd learn his song was not about sex, but depression, the two inextricably twined. Bruce would write about this. Demons haunt everyone, even rock stars. Sally's dad looked just like him, dark curls, hooked nose, more Jewish than Jersey. But Saturday mornings, after sleepovers, sweaty from his runs, it was easy to conflate, easy to see his arms, cuffs rolled, veins pulsing like a through line, easy to feel his hand, the wink, ache pushing against muscle, tugging at bone as if to say, take, save me. We who neither can be saved nor contained. Fingers brushing fingers, step close and touch, easy to get swept in the song and dance on the waxed kitchen floor. Easy now, quiet, before everyone else wakes. Easy to believe he moved just for me. Oh, thank you. I'm sorry about my dog. I don't know if you can hear the dog. He's barking. Everybody in my house has left, so he's just going to suffer through this.
No, I loved it. I felt like in the background, he was like, yes, I love this. Go. That's right. I think he was totally into it. And I love that he started barking right when you were about to say the word cat. Okay. He was like, not in my house. I really love this book. First of all, it's iconic cover. If our listeners out there aren't familiar, you need to go look it up right now. It is incredible. It's just the word jerks in sans serif font, all caps across the top, with this amazing picture of these, I don't know, 1960s folks playing tennis, 1940s maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, totally judge the book by its cover, please.
Yes, you should. You absolutely should. Yes. There is a little bit of tennis in the book, so if that's your thing, go for it. The cover is so, so great. But the book itself, I love how some stories have this almost mosaic quality, like you're building an image from these disparate parts, in much as you did in the story you just read. And no real grabbing the reader and saying, look at this, and then this is connect, you know, like no real leading the reader along. It's just sort of like presenting these images, presenting these moments. And at the end, you have this tapestry, this mosaic, which I absolutely loved. And then you have these other stories in the book that are straightforward narratives, still with beautiful imagery, beautiful language. And I just wanted to hear from you about those two different types of stories in this collection and how you came to write them the way that you did.
Okay. Real talk. Yes, this please. Book, like nothing else. So this book is sort of like, this is my cheat book. I was supposed to be working on a novel, but I'm not a novelist. Not that I'm anything necessarily, but I'm definitely not a novelist. And so, I transgressed on my novel project with short stories because I feel like, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like we all have kind of our natural sweet spot, and what we sort of gravitate, what's sort of comforting to us. And so when I landed in that murky middle of the novel, I had no freaking idea what I'm doing.
You're like, I need to go where I do know what I'm doing.
Right. Yeah. And so and I've always felt like short stories, there's something so gratifying about them. If you can get on top of them and you can get in and get out and, sort of wrangle them in a sense, it's feels so much more manageable. So yes, I mean, so yes, there's a variety of length here, right? So there's the flash pieces and then there are longer narratives. And I don't know. I think this story kind of dictates that length. Like I always kind of know when I have that kernel of a short story or the kernel of any narrative going forth, I kind of know from the beginning vaguely, oh, this is going to be a longer story. Oh, or, oh, this is going to be compressed, or, oh, this is going to be a novel.
No,
I sort of have that gut sense. Right. So that's kind of how this, evolved.
Beyond length, what do you think that like the germinating idea for these more like I know I keep saying the word mosaic, but I sat in on a Kathy Fish workshop at the Cleveland Flash Fiction Festival, and it was all about building a story using like a mosaic type process.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why it's top of mind. But like, where do you think it comes from to, or what's happening as you're writing when these types of pieces are happening versus the more straightforward narrative pieces?
Gosh, I wish I had a clever answer for you. I mean, I think maybe maybe in terms of time, I feel like a fluidity of time. So I don't know. I feel like I inhabit time that we're in the present, but we're also in the future and the past at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tend to try to capture that on the page mm-hmm. to some extent. You know, that's kind of how I approach time, which I guess taps into that mosaic feeling a little bit, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I don't even know that it's so conscious or deliberate. I just sort of am following, you know, when you get sort of a seed for a story, you know, I think you just have to listen to it. That sounds so sort of woo-woo and stupid, but
no.
There's the intrusion of all these other voices all the time, marketplace all the time. You know, there's all these people who want to tell you how to do the thing or how the thing can best be or what have you. And I think that there's something that you need to preserve, which is just you and that kernel and however it comes out to sort of trust that. And so I write really shitty first drafts, but then I do a lot of editing. Most of my writing is actually editing, but I still try to preserve that sort of the messy kernel of how it came out structurally initially.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, talking about, you know, some of the stories in the collection where you're thinking of them as maybe more mosaic, was one of the ones you were thinking of Let All the Restless Creatures Go, the Wetlands Ecology one?
I absolutely fucking love that story. And it's one of the things I want to talk about, but I would say that's one of the more traditional ones in my mind.
Me too. Well, me too, but it was one of the ones where I guess I was thinking there's kind of the alternating timelines where you are kind of getting an entire history being brought up to the narrative present. Well, there's like the one narrative present timeline and the other timeline is like catching us up on the whole history of the character. But so even there, I mean, even if that, because I do know what you're saying, some of the other ones are a little bit,
they're prose poem-y.
Sure. And obviously, sure. And also lengthwise, obviously, I think contributes to that. But even something like Let All the Restless Creatures Go, I feel like has a kind of whole, like a narrative whole feeling, like there's an opening out in these stories, even for the ones that are a little bit more traditional, a little bit more narrative, that feels kind of mosaic in a way as well, mm-hmm. where it feels like the world's open out.
I love that.
Not a question. I'm sorry, Sarah.
Okay. I love that you guys want to talk about that story because actually that one nearly landed on the cutting room floor.
Oh, you're kidding. That was one of my favorites.
It's the only one that's from a male point of view, right?
Well, there were others. So the manuscript, again, you know, I have no filter whatsoever, but the manuscript came in at, I think I submitted it at 55,000. It was, mm-hmm. it was accepted at 55,000. But Mason Jar's aesthetic is they like books that are 40,000 or and under. So that meant that I had to cut 15,000 words from the book. So, So, I mean, I absolutely, my editor, Ashley Miller, is amazing. I love her to pieces. And we were back and forth about what, you know, what to cut. And that story originally, I think it was probably when it was published in Midnight Breakfast, and I think it was maybe close to 7. It was quite long. And so anyway, it was, that was on the cutting room floor, and I fought for it because I really feel like it's the center. It's sort of the full, in my mind, it feels like the fulcrum of the book, and the book sort of hinges around that thesis. And so, so we put it back in, and, but then I actually had to trim it quite a bit and to get it down to size. But yeah, that's one that's near and dear to my heart. So I appreciate you, highlighting that one.
Yeah. It's like literally in the center of the book, basically. Yeah. And it's this character who has alopecia. So he's like baby smooth is how I think of him. Mm-hmm. And there's these women in his life, this, you know, peer in his class, his professor and his aunt and mm-hmm. his mother in a much more distant role, who all sort of like you, like he is what they need him to be. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was so clever to make him be like practically like a blank slate, you know, like he's so smooth that he's, they can just project whatever on him. Right. But then he sort of, he's so self-aware that that doesn't, harm him in a way. Mm-hmm. And it does, there's a, you know, a lot of the book is about motherhood, mm-hmm. and adolescence and very specifically, you know, like female adolescence and obviously, you know, like motherhood from the perspective of people who can give birth. And so it did feel like a very important center of the book. And I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about that rather than me just saying, and this is what I,
this no, is why. Right. No, I mean, the thing is, I mean, as both of you know, once you put a book in the world, it's not yours anymore. So it's actually way more interesting for me to hear what you take from it than what my intention is, right? Because that's kind of moot at this point. It's kind of, you know, it's up to the reader and how they experience the story. Yeah, I mean, it tonally, I know that, I mean, I think the reason why it was added, it was maybe on the chopping block was because it's at, you know, it's at a different tonal register than the rest of the stories, for sure. Mm-hmm. But that was really important. That was really important to me. The story, I mean, the extent to which the story is, the extent to which the collection as a whole, I should say, is, you know, just, you know, largely about, it's about predation in a lot of ways, right? And it's all about, you know, sort of animal instincts and primal instincts and this sort of struggle to get through it all. And I think that that's, I mean, nobody's absolved in this collection. I mean, everybody is sort of, my one friend says that she approaches the book like a Where's Waldo, you know, like who's the jerk? And like, you know, and the, you know, being that we, you know, that we all are, but I do think that there's actually, I hope at least that there's some hope, to land on, even though the last, you know, that story is, you know, it's about sort of doom and, you know, predatory forces and extinction pressing on our turtles. But I do think that, you know, we are also all the turtles as well. So I think that it's a story about sort of how to live and how to preserve a kernel of hope and dare to love anyway, even if we are also deeply fucked. So that was kind of what I was going for there. Mm.
One thing I wanted to, before we leave that story, that I just was really struck by is, I think so often you see in student work or just stories that don't fully come together for people where they are including, whether it be a medical situation for somebody or some kind of something that is being presented, something that is being othered, whether it be a situation or a condition. A lot of times when stories are not successful with that, they present it in such a heightened or underlined way. And I felt like one of the like kind of amazing strengths of Let All Restless Creatures Go was it has the power of an incredible anecdote in places, mm-hmm. in its information delivery, in that if I was just being told this story and like, if you were to take it, so you took it from 7 to 4 or whatever you did, if you were to take it down to 1200 and give me the beats of this story, I feel like, and but still preserve the sentences that were like key information, I feel like I would utterly believe it, just because the way some of the very specific details of the character's alopecia and all these things are being presented is just like life. Whereas I think so often we get tripped up on something that something like that. It sounds like such a small thing, but I think so often you see it really sink a story where it did just the opposite here.
Mm-hmm. Right. You mean like it can become a sort of fetishization instead of.
Yeah, absolutely. A fetishization or even just, you can tell that there maybe wasn't a story to tell, that there was an idea to include a particular detail, but here it just was not that way. So if anybody has not read that story and has something like that they're working with, I would absolutely suggest reading it.
Thank you so much. That's really, that means a lot to me. I mean, I do think, you know, when I'm teaching ultimately, and I'm a pain in the ass when I'm teaching, but one, you know, and I'm pushing and, but constantly, I think I'm pushing about, you know, is this intrinsic to story, right? Mm-hmm. Is this intrinsic to characters, is this intrinsic to story, or is this authorial overlay, right? And mm-hmm. sort of calling out your own, getting in touch with your own bullshit meter and sort of calling out your own crap, I think is really important. And I mean, I'm sure plenty of people can call out my own crap on this collection, but what I'm trying to do is, right, is make it so that it's integrated, so that everything feels intrinsic to character, intrinsic to story.
Yeah, totally.
Doesn't feel exhibitionist, and you know, we can get into other things, but that I'm hoping that it's not exhibitionist in that way.
Definitely not.
That word never came to my mind.
Good.
I would love to hear you talk a little bit about something that we just mentioned. There's all the motherhood in the book, mm. and sort of this overarching feeling in that you're sort of planted, you're what the family needs or else. But then there's these surprising pivots that happen, like in, oh God, what is the name of the story? Beast something.
Mm. A beastly thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Which starts with the line, then Skylar says, breastfeeding makes her horny.
That is a great story.
And just, you know, spoiler, all of a sudden she starts having sex with her son, her child's friend's father, who's mm-hmm. like a little older than her. And he just says like, oh, sweet mama, at some point. It's like, there's just these wonderful, like there's major jerks and then there's like minor jerks. And then there's just like wonderful humanity all throughout it that is just really enjoyable. But there's like these surprising pivots that the mothers make, and maybe I'm the jerk for thinking it's surprising that a mother could make those pivots. But it seems really important. And then the juxtaposition with the adolescence, which, in one story happens all in the same story, and God's children, it happens all in the same story. So I would love to hear you talk about like what was, you know, your inspiration there when you were writing those stories? What were you searching for? And you know, like what answers did you find?
Oh, I don't know that I found any answers ever. Let me know if you find any answers. Please send them my way. I'm looking for the answer. No, but I do think, I mean, this goes back to, I mean, this is the whole Madonna whore complex. I mean, we cannot reconcile in Western civilization that women, that mothers are sexual beings. Like we cannot figure this out. We cannot reconcile it. It's persistent. And yet, you know, how do we become mothers? Right.
Yeah.
It's so ironic. And so I tried to dial into that. I mean, I think I have a lot of rage and a lot of frustration, but I think what I was trying to assert, and to the extent to which I do see these stories sort of as these existing as quiet rebellions within the construct of whatever the circumstances are, the various characters, you know, nobody's necessarily busting free or, you know, imploding their lives here, but they're trying to exercise some level of agency, right? Within the
personhood.
Within their, yeah, right. Within their confines, right? And so, yeah, I mean, it's just this gross irony, the expectation that a woman becomes a mother and then becomes a vessel for her children, right? Like she becomes completely empty of all desire of her own, and she becomes just sort of lives to serve her children. And I just think that's just so deeply false and so problematic on so many levels. So that's what I was trying to explore, I guess, in A Beastly Thing.
And she, you know, like there's the moment where she, you know, like he starts drinking her milk. before they have sex. And so it's like another way of like, it's like, I don't know. It's like a subversion, but also it's okay. I don't know. I struggle with it and I think about it a lot, which I think is good. But yeah, I also don't have a question. It's just one of those moments that we're like, okay, you know, like, this is a choice, or is it a choice? I don't know, because he kind of just takes it, right?
What, that he's turned on by her milk?
Yeah, and then he just like starts drinking it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember if she like offers it or whatever, but
no, she's just leaking, right?
I mean, yeah, and so he just happens. Yeah, it's like it's okay because it was there for him to take, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, look, there's such a double standard, which we can talk about that all day long, but right. I mean, sure. Yeah. He takes it. She gives it. She's, you know, what she takes for herself is so little. But she does take from him. And in terms of this overarching, you know, and this is what my novel is coming out in October, is same theme, I guess. I just, you know, we own our shit and we just, you know, explore it over and over again, but this question about predation and like the predatory nature of humanity, right? So what does she take from him? What does he take from her?
What is her role in that?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's constantly interesting. It's infinitely interesting to me. And I don't know, maybe someday I'll outgrow it, but doesn't seem like I'm outgrowing it any day soon.
No, same. And you know, like I keep hearing about like, oh, there's just too many motherhood, you know, every motherhood is everywhere. Motherhood. It's just too much. And I could fucking read it all day long. I love it so much. I feel like it is, how can it not be intrinsic to our every, you know, emotion practically.
Right.
As people.
And yet at the same time, how frustrating, right?
I know. As I'm saying that.
Like, oh, this is a story about motherhood. Like, fuck that. It's not a story about motherhood. It's
right.
Right.
Who happens to have these babies that are leached to her, and like she has all these other desires, right? And she wants to have life. And so, and yet it becomes categorized as such. And it's a motherhood story and therefore feels somewhat taboo because she's sexualized, right? So it takes on this whole thing.
Yep.
And I think, I mean, that's when Lindsay and I had talked a lot about this specifically when one of the novels recently Lindsay wrote went on submission. So you were hearing that, right, Lindsay? I mean, that was, and I think you and I talked about like, there's no way what they're actually saying and what they actually mean is there's too many, you know, novels about motherhood. It's just like, it's either misogyny or it's something else. But like to actually have that as it's bizarre because like you said, yes. Okay. Maybe there's a mother in the book, but to say that it is about motherhood is fucking crazy. I mean, give me a break. Books are about a myriad of things always. So, I mean, it's a cop out.
Yeah. If anything, motherfuckers, that novel was about divorce. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So put that novel in your pipe.
I want to read that novel.
Yeah. Well, you can, you're the only one.
Check your email.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is winnowing down, right? We're so quick to categorize. We're so quick to put in boxes. We're so quick to say that it's about this one thing. And it's about, and when we're put in that box and we're told that it's about this one thing, that's what we have to slam our fists against over.
Yeah. And it's so easy to turn the word mom into an insult, you know? Mm-hmm. And we do it all the time. I do it to myself. And, you know, and there's repercussions for that. You know, there's consequences for that. There's, you know, like, I don't want to be taken too seriously, but I want to be taken seriously, you know? So it's like, it's difficult. It's very difficult. The other day I said to my 6-year-old, I'm a person. Okay. And I was like, oh God, I need to talk to somebody else about this.
Right.
And so here you are.
Here we are all together on a Saturday night.
Yeah. There you go. Sarah, were there collections that you were, you said that the genesis of this project was, you know, kind of transgressing on working on a novel, but were the collections as you were putting together Jerks that you were looking to either for structural inspiration or even in a more granular way, just like some of these stories, did you have stories that you were kind of thinking about as you were drafting any of these, or did you not really approach the project that way?
And I love that question. Thank you, Alex. Well, two parts. First of all, yeah. So this was not such a conscious project. This was, again, procrastination. But once I had written the short story Jerks and got that published, I thought, God damn it, if I ever write another collection, I'm totally naming it Jerks. So that was kind of boring. It was soaring in the back of my head. And I love this question because it's one thing to have a bunch of short stories, and it's another thing to have a collection that's cohesive and that all sort of resonates. You know, and then speaks to each other in, mm-hmm. in juxtaposition and in accrual and that, you know, kind of works. And so I do think that there are so many short story collections that I love that do that. I'll just shout out a few, but, you know, Rebecca Schiff's The Bed Moved is so cohesive. I love that. And it's so tight and small. Nina McConaughey's, Cowboys and East Indians, I think is again, also super, super tight. And they all fit together so well. And it's looking at like how the beats, you know, you might have a prevalent theme. I'm sure you do have a prevalent theme, but you know, how are the stories sort of, riffing off of that theme and sort of advancing it from different angles. So you're not just hitting it from the same beat, right? Danielle Lazarin's collection Back Talk, I think, does that really well. And Margaret Malone's collection, People Like You, do you know that book? It's really
oh my god,
she's so good. Margaret Malone's People Like You, it's really, really tight. And again, it's so much emotional restraint, but the stories knit together so beautifully. And I don't know that they were influencing me, but I definitely was paying attention to collections that I think work really well as a collection and say something as a whole, as opposed to some collections that are just collected stories and feel sort of more, just, you know, looser, in their arrangement. Mm-hmm.
How were you thinking about arranging this collection?
Again, so I, the last story of the collection, The Polish Girl, was the last story I wrote. And once I wrote that one, I knew that I had the end. And I knew that I had the beginning. Again, you can kind of see the accrual. I mean, it's some, and I don't want to say it's totally chronological because it's not, but I do have, you know, the initial story is sort of, you know, the sexual awakening, the sort of adolescent girl, right? And early exposure to the deception of men, and her own, and not only the deception of men, but the predation within her own bunk, right? This whole idea of cannibalism and survival, you know, and how we, you know, take advantage of one another and so forth. But, so I knew I had the beginning and the end, and then I just tried to look closely at, again, how they were speaking to each other, both next to one another and an accrual. So that was sort of how it all fell out. And then of course I took out a bunch of stories as well.
Give me those stories. Give me the beefy jerks.
The beefy jerks, the ones that landed on the cutting room floor. I know it's I have a bunch of stories. I mean, some they didn't, and a bunch of them didn't. I thought maybe I would put them in my first collection and they didn't. I think, you know what it is, and I like these stories. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say I like them, because, you know, who likes their work? I don't know that I really would ever say that I like my work, but the extent, you know, but I think that they hold as stories, but the problem with them is that they hit the same note, right? So they're not introducing anything new or anything necessarily different than what I have. And I think you have to be sort of merciless, in that regard, and, just, you know, kill those babies if they're not advancing.
Die.
Cold heart. Got a cold heart.
Sarah, you described your comfort zone as being in within short stories or shorter work, and yet you have a novel coming out soon. Can you tell us a little bit about how you transitioned into like a novelistic mindset, and just process wise, how was that for you?
Not fun. yeah. So, I mean, this is, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier with you all about how I really feel like the story sort of dictates a length in sort of a real instinctive way. And you just kind of, for me, at least, I feel like I have a gut sense of the story that I want to tell, of where it's going to fall. And so many, many years ago, I had this idea for a story that felt long to me. But I really didn't know what I was doing. And again, I think this is this is a fault of my own for sure. I'll shoulder that. But also, I mean, I think MFA programs, they teach you the short story maybe, but it's really hard to, at least my MFA program, which was a million years ago, I'm rather old, but we never learned novel craft whatsoever. And so it was a real significant leap for me. And it took me a really long time. And I learned a shit ton about novel writing. And I learned a lot about myself as well in the process, but yeah, it was not, you know, and now, I mean, now I'm excited to be working on another project that's of novel length, but, it's not a natural space for me, which is, I guess, all the more reason for me to want to claw at it and try to do it. Cause it's a real challenge for me. I think partly, you know, as again, to go back to the whole motherhood trope, I think early on when I first conceived of this idea for the novel that's finally making its way this fall, my kids were still pretty young, and it was hard. I don't know if you find this. I mean, Lindsay and Alex, both of you with young, you know, you both still have really young kids. My kids are now much older. They're in teenagers, and they don't, you know, they don't give a shit about me anymore at all. Oh, man. I mean, no, I they're amazing, but it's just, you know, the demands have shifted so much. So I have much more time to focus on a sustained narrative. But and when I was first thinking about this novel and chewing on it, I mean, time was pretty much non-existent. So the idea of, you know, stealing your moments, and going back in, it's just so much easier for me, at least, to be writing short stories in that space. It was really sort of logistically challenging to try to stretch out a novel, to try to sit with a sustained narrative, as well. So, I don't know. I think I lost. I'm sorry. I'm having
more. No.
I lost your question, Alex.
No. No, you're good. No, okay. It's just because I can really, I think, you know, several years ago, I would have described myself the same way, where it's like, you know, I definitely feel more comfortable with stories, rather write stories. But then this last novel that I wrote, it took me 5 years, you know, to kind of get it all the way. And my brain shifted. And it's like, now I'm thinking in more novel terms, I feel like, and it's harder for me to sit down and write something short, which is wild, because before I feel like all I was thinking about was short stories. But a lot of it too, and this is the other question I wanted to ask as a follow-up to that, was my reading changed so much as a result of, you know, working on a novel project for so long that I was pretty much only reading novels. Did your reading change while you were working on Lech, or were you still kind of into the same type of stuff in the same grooves you were before?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I just want to go back to what you said before, which was that sort of once you start flexing that muscle over time, then that's kind of what you want to do. And I find the same way, like right now, Again, like, I feel like a hypocrite. I'm teaching shorts. I teach a short story. I teach flash fiction, but I haven't really been writing it right now because my interest really, my interest is in the novel. And it presents such a unique challenge, one that's different than the challenges that flash fiction presents or that short stories present. Right. And so because it's not natural to me, it's kind of the space that I want to inhabit. When I was working on the novel over many, many, many goddamn years, I really did try. I was trying not to read so many short story collections because I was, for all those reasons. And I was trying to sort of teach myself, structure and how to, this is the novel that's coming out is 5 different points of view and whatever. I created a whole lot of problems for myself. And so how to solve those problems. And so I was really trying to read novels, but then I cheat on that too, because I guess I'm just transgressive by nature.
It's 5 different points of view because it sort of scratches the itch of like shorter fiction does, you're able to like jump around to these perspectives in a way that like your flash fiction and your short stories allowed you to do as well. So it kind of kept you, because I find myself doing the same thing when I'm writing novels is like, well, this will be from the perspective of 20 to 25 different people, and then I'll have a novel.
Well, I mean, again, whatever I've done, this is for reader, listeners out there, whatever I've done, you should do the exact opposite. Do not listen to me. I think that's correct. I think it probably did grow out of that, that restlessness that I have. The 5th point of view actually was an 11th hour addition. It was 4 points of view, but they did steadily start. I think it started at 2 points of view, and then it started to just fracture and kind of expand. But at one point, I have a really good girlfriend who's wonderful. She's a poet, songwriter, Karen Pittleman. Karen, I love you if you're listening. And she read the manuscript in early stages, and she astutely diagnosed it with what she called story-itis. I did have, I had to kind of, I had to treat that chronic illness, which I think will always live inside me.
How did you treat it? What did you do?
I mean, I think looking at narrative tension, looking at how to advance the story, looking at like understanding that what we think of as sort of the resonant takeaways of a short story don't necessarily resonate in the same level, same way when you're dealing with a novel, right? And so that you need to kind of keep pushing ahead. I have a tendency, and maybe this was kind of what you were getting at earlier, Lindsay, with the mosaic, like I like to write sort of circular or somewhat claustrophobic narratives where the beginning and the end don't necessarily look all that different, but that's really frustrating place for the reader to be, and doesn't work so well for a novel. So trying to sort of break those patterns was key to kind of opening it up for me.
Mm. Yeah, I can so relate to what you're both saying, because there was a time that I thought I would never write a novel. I just didn't feel capable of it. And now, like you're saying, Alex, it's like a challenge for me to write something short,
Yeah. I mean, you wrote 2 novels last year.
I know. That's how I think now. And there was so long that I just believe that wasn't in me, that it's wild to now be like, no, let's go back to our roots. Let's, mm-hmm.
Wait, can we just pause for a second? Because that's amazing.
It is amazing.
What is?
You wrote 2 novels in a year, Lindsay?
Last year. But think about last year.
Can we just pause and can you tell us all of your wisdom right now?
I was on something. I don't know. I had a fire under my ass. There were the first one was just something that I really wanted to write. And I had a sick dog who would get up really early in the morning to go out and pee. And then, I would just sit with her in the early mornings downstairs and just do my writing until my kids woke up. And then I would do writing like in the parking lot of my kid's school. It felt like something I was like, I had to do. So it was an imperative. And then the second novel, it was a complete rewrite of my motherhood / divorce novel, hoping that maybe someone would like it then. I don't know if I don't have as much time as I did, but I think I burned myself out a little bit. And like what you were saying, Sarah, about when your kids were little and how you realized, like, I just don't have the time. Like maybe you had the time, but you didn't have the space in your brain. Right. And that's how I feel right now, is that I need to rest now. And so like every once in a while, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm going to write a little bit on this other thing that I've started, and I will. Mm-hmm. But then part of me is also like, no, no, no. It's okay to rest. It's okay to just, you know, take a break.
Yeah.
Which is really scary, because I never have done that. I have never been that person. I've always written. I've always had some kind of project I'm working on. So it feels like rebellious against myself, which is cool, but also scary.
Well, as the queen slacker over here, who's taken, you know, many, many years off of writing and never thought that, you know, I would go back to it. I do, maybe this is just some gross rationalization, but I believe strongly in the fallow period. I'm all about the fallow. So
I've earned it, you know,
especially after having written two books in sort of a fever in rapid succession. I mean, that's, you know, like, you know, to give yourself the space around the work and to kind of feed that, you know, feed the well and let it kind of refill, I think is such a generosity that you can do for yourself and for your work as well. And then of course it's going to come, you know, it's going to come because it's always there, and it's not, you know, but you, I think that's amazing. I mean, that's amazing. I want what she's having.
Right. I'm so close, knock wood, to all three of my kids being in school. Like my daughter, she's going to be 4. So she's going to go to pre-K 4 in the fall. I'm so close to having more time and like,
yeah,
more quiet, you know, like more like able to hear myself. And I think that's really what's like, that's what goes away when you have so many goddamn kids. It's just right. Like,
it's the constant interruption. It's the inability. Yeah. I mean, at least for me, it was the inability to complete a thought in my head, much less a thought on paper. And so, yeah, I mean, again, that's where I sort of cleave to flash fiction, because at least I could do maybe, you know, I couldn't do 5,000 words. I couldn't do 40,000 words. I couldn't do 70,000 words, but I could do maybe, you know, 500 or 750. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that felt like a small good thing.
Yes. Yes. For me. Yeah. And I've been feeling all this anxiety, and I realized, oh, my anxiety is stemming from the fact that I'm trying to do things when I know I don't have time to do them. And it's such a simple thing, you know, it's such a simple realization just to be like, oh, I'm freaking out because I actually don't have the resources to do that. Okay. You know, but it takes a while to get there. So I'm just letting myself do that.
Yeah. Be kind to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Year. Yeah.
And I'm like reading like a crazy person. I'm just always reading. So it's like I'm just in another phase of my life.
Yeah. It's amazing how much you both have to read for this show, let alone, you know, for pleasure. Are you reading good things for pleasure?
Not I, just do, for yeah. I do. Yeah. I do. I do both. Yeah. Alex, introduced me to, books on audio. So that's been huge. For a while I was in like the bottom dregs of true crime podcasts, just like just utter trash, like someone like whispering under the covers or something, like nothing good, because I had listened to all the good ones. And then I realized like, oh, I can listen to true crime books. And that's been wonderful. So I'm in the middle of that and not reading for the podcast and whatever else I can get in.
Did I ever tell you my favorite murder story, Lindsay?
No.
Okay. So did you ever listen to that one?
You know what? I cannot get into that one. And I know everyone loves it. No, no, no. I know it's beloved.
No, whatever. So Britt and I both used to listen to it. This is, you know, maybe 5-6 years ago when it was like really popular, I feel like. because there was a period where I feel like everyone was listening to it.
Yeah, I think it's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. And so they had a live show here when we lived in the city, when we were in Chicago, and we're like, let's go. So we get in there and they come out and they're telling these stories about real murders and everybody's cheering. And I kind of like look at Britt and she looks at me like halfway through and we're like, what the fuck are we doing?
Like, oh my gosh. Are you
like,
serious?
Swear to God. And we left. And I don't mean like, I do not mean that from a moral high ground place because I'm a complete fucking asshole and it doesn't matter. But when you're in the room and you're hearing it, it's just like, you know, you have the realization like, God damn, like this can't really be entertainment for me right now. I don't know.
That's what Sarah's thinking right now, being on our podcast.
What are you talking about?
No, we don't. Totally. No, we're teasing. But yeah, I don't know. For some reason, I just like got like someone shook me awake and I was like, holy fuck. All right. Can't do it.
That's such a great story that you guys have now, like in your marriage, you know, where it's just like, you guys were totally on the same page at the exact same moment. Do you remember
that one time we were on the same page?
Yeah, we have that. We will never not have that.
We're going to have it forever.
Anyway, I cannot wait for Lech. It's coming out when?
October.
October. It comes out on Tortoise. Hi, Jerry.
Jerry. That's right. Alex, you're a tortoise.
That's right.
Yeah.
Jerry is the one guest that we ever had on our pod where I forgot to press record.
It was brutal. Oh my God.
My dreams to this day.
We felt like absolute dog shit.
It was a really good conversation too.
It was. He'll come back.
Yeah.
He'll come back. I mean, big shout out to Jerry because he does the job of like 10 people.
Yeah, he does. He's a great guy. Because
he loves it, you know, like
he absolutely loves it.
Yeah. He's just like in everything on the line and on the design and he's an animal and yeah. I feel really grateful to be working with him. It's so interesting to be, you know, I've been now with a bunch of different small presses and everybody has their style and anyway it's fun being with you know, Jerry's got some good energy, so
yeah,
he's a force. And in the meantime, he wrote like a 750 page novel.
Yeah.
That he had to do like all this research for.
I know. So I want what he's having too.
Yeah. He just doesn't sleep, I guess.
Yeah.
We really love talking to you.
Thanks for love coming jerks. On, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. These stories are great.
This was a treat. I appreciate it so much. I adore you both and have a great night.
Yes. Yeah. You too. Cannot wait for your next book and keep going on this other novel that's driving you nuts.
Yes.
So much. And I can't wait to read both of your novels that you wrote in a year. Let's
see. We'll see. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, I loved this book. It's like she said, Mason Jar Press, you know, they publish on the shorter side. So there's absolutely no fat. It's full of sudden sex. Yeah, it's funny and beautiful. And you'll just want to display it in your home because the cover is so wonderful. And the cover is by Ian Anderson. Good job, Ian. Good job, Mason Jar Press. What else? Have you ever paused, or not paused, muted so that you could burp?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. The main, I usually mute so I could open another beer.
Mm. Yeah. So I read Jerks. I'm listening to a true crime book by the Mindhunter guy.
Oh.
And let me tell you, Mason Jar Press could show him a thing or two because he needed to trim like the last 6 chapters off this thing.
When you say the Mindhunter guy, do you mean the guy who wrote the book Mindhunter? Is there a book Mindhunter?
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is a book called Mindhunter, but he also wrote a bunch of other books, including this one, which is called When a Killer Calls, which is about this idiot who killed some people. And but now it's just like the minutia of the trial.
Is it John E. Douglas? Is that who we're talking about?
I think it's John Douglas. He writes him with this other guy. but I think it's John who's the guy. Okay. But I'm also reading Empire of Pain by Patrick Radden Keefe, which is about the
hearing about this book. Yeah.
Yeah. About OxyContin. And it's like, no wonder people don't trust the FDA or pharmaceutical companies or anything, because all they ever did was lie about all of it. So I am wearing tinfoil on my head right now.
No, I like that.
That's a result of this book.
Just anecdotally, my OxyContin story is when I first started working at the grocery store almost 10 years ago, like within the first couple months, I threw my back out. Ooh. And I went to a urgent care, and that's what they gave me.
And what year was that?
2013.
Okay.
2012. Like just like 10 years ago. So I threw my back out 2 years ago. And when you go in to, I went into a similar place. It wasn't the same one, but they give you nothing even close to that now.
They just give you big, like, ibuprofens, right?
Yeah, honestly. And, you know, recommend like hot, cold or whatever. But yeah, I mean, even I remember thinking it was so great. I mean, even like 10 years ago, I was like, you're going to give me what?
It's like, no, they did. They, for both my C-sections and the surgery I had after Judith, they gave me oxycodone, which is
right.
And I took it once after.
That's what they gave me. Codeine.
Codeine or whatever. And I took it once. I took my one dose of it after Towns was born. And it was so strong that like I threw up. It was like crazy how like immediately I was like completely bewildered. So I stopped taking it after that. And, but they still were prescribing it back then.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. I'm excited because I'm going to read, is it called The Apology by Christian Tabordo? He's coming on,
by the
way.
Thank you.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm excited to read Christian's book and talk to him next week. He's always really fun.
Yeah. Christian's great.
And a total like badass. Although I think if he heard me say he was a badass, he'd be like, ugh, shut up.
He's an original. He's definitely himself.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't really have anything else. I can't think of anything. Empty brain.
Okay. Well, we don't have to push it, you know?
Oh, I know.
So I'll talk to you next week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Hickley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Yeah, yeah.